Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Big apology for yesterday's episode, the mix-up. I accidentally uploaded the previous day's episode again, so you got the same episode 2 days in a row. It would have appeared to be the correct episode. All the naming and everything was right. I just uploaded the wrong file, and then I didn't figure that out until the next day. So thank you to those who let me know, and the kind words around letting me know. It wasn't just, hey, you messed up. It was actually some very nice things said. Atomic Gecko said this: thank you so much for coordinating this read-along, this subreddit, this podcast. I wouldn't be enjoying or reading at all, Anna Karenina, if it wasn't for your effort. I noticed that the podcast episode uploaded most recently is the exact same as the prior. Do you have the most recent one? You can upload again. Thanks again from a daily and much appreciative listener slash participant. How's that, hey? You could have just said, hey, you messed up, fix it. But taking an opportunity to be so friendly, and I appreciate that. So thanks so much. It is fixed now, so you should have been able to see that the episode was re-uploaded, and it should be all good. Chapter 32. Mr. Karenin is not the jealous type, or so he reckons. What are your thoughts? I am Norwegian, said Sir Yosa. Inspires disappointment in Anna. That's her son. What is that about? When Anna sees Lydia again, she notices all of her flaws as if for the first time. Does she not like anyone in St. Petersburg, or is she just noticing the contrast from Vronsky and her Moscow side of the family? I bring up this because the footnote mentions that this is a theme that will be resumed later in the book. Lydia brings up Pravdin, a famous Pan-Slavist. A Pan-Slavist was an adherent of the movement which sought the liberation of the Slav nations from Ottoman and Habsburg rule, and ultimately advocated for the political and spiritual union of the Slavs under the leadership of Russia. The Slavonic Benevolent Committees were private organizations which sought to give help to subjugated Slavs outside Russia, and were the only legal means for helping southern Slavs resist the Ottoman Empire in the 1870s. While Dostoevsky never mentioned Pan-Slavism, he did bring up the subject of Slavs in the Ottoman Empire. This was likely the topic that most inflamed his xenophobia. Maybe someone else, maybe Tekrific, knows more about this than I do. Well, I certainly don't. So I'm right at the start of the learning curve, and I can see that Tekrific didn't make a response, so maybe he doesn't either, or maybe he just didn't see this yet. Yula is a pimp, said, might just be a reflection of her dissatisfaction with life that could lead her into an affair with Vronsky, or a general statement that, with distance, we begin to think about things and our relationships abstractly, which leads to idealizing them and subsequent disappointment when compared to reality. Swim, said the mummerfish, he said, her sin, like his father, produced in Anna a feeling of disappointment. Her fancy had pictured him nicer than he was in reality. She had come down to reality to enjoy him as he was. She had to come down to reality to enjoy him as he was. I can relate to this. I travelled as a consultant when my sons were growing up, and now they are scattered across the United States. It is very easy to idolize them, both then and now, and when away, and I do need to acclimate to reality when I see them, and they do too, lol. My sister-in-law, in general, is too impulsive. Well, isn't that calling the kettle black? And in reading and answering the notes and letters that had accumulated on her table, the 19th century equivalent of dealing with email. Yeah, it is too, eh? When you sit down and you haven't checked your email for a few days and you're going, oh God, maybe I should just get a new email address and start over. Maybe I should just start over my whole life. Pan-Slavism. First time I've heard of this. When you search the term, all sorts of references pop up. In brief, Pan-Slavism was a movement in the mid-19th century aimed at unity of all the Slavic peoples. The main focus was in the Balkans, where the South Slavs had been ruled and oppressed for centuries by the three great empires, Austria-Hungary, the Ottoman Empire, and Venice. It was also used as a political tool by both the Russian Empire and its successor, the Soviet Union. Well, I still don't really know much about that. Politics is definitely not my strong suit, nor is history, nor is geography. So, I'm stupid. But I'm learning. I'm getting there. Now, by the way, something happened with Patreon. I've still got Patreon, by the way. The Hemingway List. Patreon.com/TheHemingwayList. So this is what happened. This probably won't affect anyone, but I'll just let you guys know. We had one of the things that was a benefit of having a Patreon, being a Patreon supporter, is that you got your own special, like, flair in the subreddit that showed that you were a Patreon supporter. Apparently, Patreon or Reddit or both of them are no longer supporting that, so they're getting rid of that feature. So that won't be, you won't have that special flair anymore. I don't think anyone ever actually got that special flair anyway. I think it was something you had to set up. So anyway, just letting you know, because I got a message through both Patreon and Reddit. Shall we continue? By the way, if you want to support the podcast, check out the Patreon page. There are zero rewards, except for my gratitude. Chapter 33 goes like this. Karenin returned from... Closed the book accidentally. Karenin returned from the ministry at 4 o'clock, but as often happened, he had no time to go up and see his wife. He went straight to his study to receive some petitioners and sign a few documents brought by his private secretary. At the Karenins' dinners, there were usually about 3 visitors. This time there came an old lady, a cousin of Karenin's, the director of a department, the director's wife, and a young man who had been recommended to Karenin for a post under him. Anna went into the drawing room to entertain them. Exactly at 5, the bronze clock, style of Peter I, had not finished striking. Karenin entered in evening dress, with a white tie and 2 stars on his coat, as he had to attend an official meeting directly after dinner. Every moment of his life was filled up and apportioned, and in order to find time to perform all the tasks allotted to each day, he observed the strictest regularity. Without haste and without rest was his motto. He entered the room, greeted everybody, and quickly sat down, smiling at his wife. "So my solitude has come to an end. You wouldn't believe how uncomfortable," he put special emphasis on the word uncomfortable, "it is to dine alone." At dinner, he spoke a little about Moscow affairs with his wife, asking with an ironical smile about Stephen Oblonsky, but for the most part, the conversation was general and dealt with Petersburg service and social affairs. After dinner, he spent 30 minutes with his guests, and then, with a smile, pressed his wife. After dinner, he spent 30 minutes with his guests, and then, having again with a smile pressed his wife's hand, went away to the council. That evening, Anna went neither to see the Princess Betsy Savetskaya, who, having heard of Anna's return, had invited her, nor to the theatre, where she had a box for that evening. Her chief reason for not going was that a dress on which she had counted on was not ready. Altogether, when, after her visitors had left, Anna busied herself with her toilet, she was much vexed. Before going to Moscow, she, being an adept at dressing on comparatively little money, left 3 dresses to be altered. She wanted them made up so that they should be unrecognizable, and they were to have been sent home 3 days ago, but she now found that 2 were not ready at all. While the 3rd had not been done in the way she wished, the dressmaker came to explain that it was better as she had done it, and Anna lost her temper to such a degree that she afterwards felt ashamed. Completely to regain her composure, she went to the nursery and spent the evening with her son. She put him to bed, made the sign of the cross over him, and tucked him up. She was glad she had not gone out that evening, but had spent it so pleasantly at home. She felt light-hearted and tranquil, and saw clearly that what in the train had appeared so important had merely been an ordinary and trivial incident of society life, and that there was no reason for her to feel ashamed, or for anyone to blame her. She sat down by the fire with an English novel and awaited her husband. Exactly at 9:30 there was a ring at the front door, and he entered the room. "Here you are at last," she said, holding out her hand to him. He kissed it and seated himself beside her. "In general, I see that your journey has been a success," said he. "Yes, quite," she replied, and related everything that had happened from the beginning. Her journey with the Countess Vronskaya, her arrival, the accident at the railway station. Then she spoke of her pity, first for her brother and then for Dolly. "I don't think that one can excuse such a man, even though he is your brother," remarked Karenin severely. Anna smiled. She knew he had said that in order to show that no consideration of kinship could hinder the expression of his sincere opinion. She knew that trait in her husband's character, knew it, and liked it. "I am glad it has all ended satisfactorily, and that you are back again," he continued. "But what are they saying there about the new statute I carried in the council?" Anna had heard nothing about the statute, and felt ashamed that she had so lightly forgotten what was of such importance to him. "Here, on the contrary, it has made quite a stir," he said, with a self-satisfied smile. Anna saw that he wanted to tell her something pleasant to himself about that affair, and by questioning she led him on to tell her about it. With the same self-satisfied smile, he told her about the ovations he had received on account of the enactment of that statute. "I was very, very pleased. It shows that at last a clear and reasonable view of the matter is beginning to be firmly held among us." Having finished his second cup of tea and cream, and his bread and butter, he rose and went into his study. "And have you not been out anywhere? You must have been dull," he said. "Oh no," she answered, rising and following him through the room to his study. "And what are you reading now?" she asked. "I am reading about the Duc de Lille, de Lille, Poise des Enfers," he replied, "a very remarkable book." Anna smiled, as one smiles at the weakness of people one loves, and slipped her hand under his arm, walked with him to the study door. She knew his habit, which had become a necessity, of reading in the evening. She knew that in spite of his time being almost entirely absorbed by the duties of his post, he considered it incumbent on him to follow everything of importance that appeared in the world of thought. She also knew that, really, he was interested in political, philosophic, and theological books, and that art was quite foreign to his nature. Yet, in spite of this, or rather because of it, he never ignored anything that caused a stir in that sphere, but considered it his duty to read everything. She knew that in the sphere of politics, philosophy, and theology, Alexis Alexandrovich doubted and searched, but in questions of art, poetry, and especially music, which he did not at all understand, he held most definite and firm opinions. He liked talking of Shakespeare, Raphael, and Beethoven, and about the importance of the new schools of poetry and music, which in his mind were all classified with very logical exactitude. "Well, God bless you," she said at the door of the study, where a shaded candle and a bottle of water had been placed, ready for him beside his armchair, "and I will go and write to them in Moscow." He pressed her hand and again kissed it. "After all, he is a good man, truthful, kind, and remarkable in his own sphere," said Anna to herself when she had returned to her room, as if defending him from someone who accused him and declared it was impossible to love him. "But why do his ears stick out so? Or has he had his hair cut?" Exactly at midnight, when Anna was still sitting at her writing table finishing a letter to Dolly, she heard the measured tread of slippered feet, and Karenin entered, freshly washed, his hair brushed, and a book under his arm. It's time," said he, with a peculiar smile, going into their bedroom. And what right had he to look at him? As he did, thought Anna, remembering how Vronsky had looked at Karenin. When she was undressed, she went into the bedroom, but on her face not only was there not a trace of that animation which during her stay in Moscow had sparkled in her eyes and smile, but on the contrary, the fire in her now seemed quenched or hidden somewhere very far away. Alright, there we go. Another chapter down. Poor Anna. She's a bit disillusioned, I think, with her hubby. Now, I've just had a little sneaky peek at the next chapter. Just as I was saying that, I was curious how long the next chapter is. And I noticed that it's the last chapter in part one. So, it should bring a close to something, I suppose. I'm not really sure about the structure of the book, but I would say it's going to be significant in some way, so that's exciting. One more chapter for part one. All right, have your say. Excuse me. Have your say over at the subreddit. Check out the Patreon if you would like. And thank you for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.